Okay, so welcome to the Oxford Museum of Natural History, and welcome to this show called Accelerate.
So Accelerate, it's about particle accelerators. So before we get going, does anyone know what a particle accelerator does? Yeah, that's right. So what we do is it accelerates particles. It makes them go faster. And you're dead right. Eventually, we want to smash them together and try to see what happens.
Right, so a particle accelerator takes particles and gives them energy. That's what we mean by an accelerator. And there's actually, today, a recipe that we're going to follow in order to make a particle accelerator, and it's up here on the screen. So the first thing we're going to need is some particles. So we're going to talk about what do we mean by particles in the first place, what types of particles, and where on earth are we going to get them from. And the next thing we need to do is give them that energy. So we're going to have to figure out a way of giving these tiny particles lots of energy somehow. Of course, there's no point just having things whizzing around all over the place, so we have to figure out how we're going to control a beam of particles. And then next, we're going to get those beams, and as you said, we're going to smash them into each other in a particle collision. And then finally, there's no point doing all of that amazing science if we're not going to be able to see what's happened. So we'll also talk about how you detect things and talk about different detectors of particles. So that's our recipe.
Okay, so there's actually something which some of you guys might still have at home, it's a bit old-fashioned now, that has all these different components inside it. Can anyone guess what that might be?
Something at home.
Shout out.
Something that's got particles. You might have had at home when you were very little. You might still have one. Any guesses?
Shout out, please.
Microwave.
Microwave?
Good idea.
Close.
Another one.
Close.
Any other ideas?
Something similar? A little bit different. Sorry, motorbike, no.
It's more fun to watch.
Not a video player, it's near the video player.
That's right, we got TV from down here.
Television.
So this is a picture of an old-fashioned television. So modern flat-screen televisions don't work like this, but the big old ones do. And this actually is like a tiny particle accelerator. At the back, we've got the cathode, and that's where you get your particles from. The particles, in this case, are electrons.
And so then, electrons, what are they?
Electrons. Does anyone know what charge an electron has?
Is charge positive or negative? Do you guys
shout
know?
Shout out, please. Negative. Someone said
it's
negative.
It's negative.
That's
negative.
Right. Because it's negatively charged, the anodes are positively charged. What happens when you get a negative charge and a positive charge? Do they attract or repel? Attract, that's right. So the electron is accelerated. That's how we give the electrons energy. Then we use the focusing coil and the deflecting coil as magnets to bend the path of the electrons. And we'll talk a bit about how that works later. So that's the control part of our recipe. And finally, the electron smashes into that fluorescent screen at the front. So that's the collision and the detection all sort of rolled into one.
All right, so that's kind of suits our recipe. That's kind of a little tiny weeny particle accelerator. But I wouldn't really call a television a particle accelerator. So if that's, you know, really, really tiny, can anyone tell me where the biggest particle accelerator in the world is or what it might be called? Has anyone heard of it? It's in Switzerland. Does anyone know what it's called? Shout it out. I heard it somewhere there, the Large Hadron Collider, that's right, or the LHC. And it is the world's biggest particle accelerator. It is 27 kilometres in circumference, and it's buried 100 metres underground, underneath the Swiss-French border near Geneva. And this is a picture if you went down inside the tunnel. Now, inside those magnets there is actually the coldest place on Earth. Inside those magnets, it is colder than the temperature of outer space, which is a pretty impressive thing. Now, you can also notice it almost looks like it's going in a straight line. That's actually how big the circumference of that huge circle is. So that's the world's biggest machine, and they take two beams of protons this time, positively charged particles, in opposite directions, and they smash them together in four different places around the ring. And where they smash them together, that's where they put these massive particle detectors, and this one is called the compact muon solenoid, or CMS, and we'll talk a bit more about those detectors later. So that's a Large Hadron Collider.
Okay, so that's a pretty big particle accelerator. We've only got one of those. How many particle accelerators do you guys think there are in total in the whole world? Four, more than four.
More than four? Like 8 million, less than 8 million.
7 million.
Less than 7 million. Less than 6 million.
Not in the millions.
Oh, calm down a little bit. So I heard 50,000.
It's actually About 20,000, which is quite a lot. We're not counting things like televisions, but just bigger particle accelerators, which are used in all kinds of different places where you might have come across them in your everyday life.
Okay, so 20,000 particle accelerators, that's actually quite a lot. So we obviously don't live very near to the Large Hadron Collider, but can anyone tell me where they think their nearest particle accelerator might be? So from here, where do you think the nearest particle accelerator might be? Any guesses? Can I have hands up? Yep.
There's one near Oxford called Diamond. There's actually one even closer than that. Yeah, so we've actually cheated a bit. This guy's just right. We're in the Oxford University science area.
Yeah.
So there is actually one just down the road.
So we have cheated. There's a couple down the road in the physics department. But normally, your nearest particle accelerator is actually in a hospital. And we have a map up here. There we go. Google Maps of most of the particle accelerators in the UK that we know of, and the green ones are used in hospitals for cancer treatment. Most of the red ones are, there's not very many of them, but they're the ones that are actually used by scientists for doing science. And so you'll see near us in Oxford here, there's a couple of green ones up there, they're at the John Radcliffe Hospital nearby, and there's a couple of red ones within Oxford, and they're actually used for radiocarbon dating for historical purposes. And then down south there, that's the lab where I actually work, which is near Didcot, where there's two accelerators which are a little bit bigger, which are called Isis and Diamond, which we'll come across a little bit later. So that's the nearest one to you.
Okay, so we found out that there are particle accelerators everywhere, and we found out there's a really, really big one in Switzerland. Let's go back to our recipe. How do we build one of these things? Well, the first thing we're going to need is particles. So what kind of particles are we talking about in a particle accelerator?
Ooh, we've mentioned a couple already. Can anyone tell me types of particles they might know? And we're talking about subatomic particles, particles inside the atom usually. Do you know? Neutrons, protons, and electrons. That is exactly right. That's exactly what's in the atom. But the only one of those that we can't use is the neutron. Can anyone tell me why you might not be able to use a neutron? Do you know? Thank you. Excellent. Well done. So it doesn't have an electric charge. So we can only use particles which have an electric charge, which within the atom includes the proton and the electron.
So in the Large Hadron Collider, we actually use protons. So where can we get protons from? Can anyone think?
Do you know what we need? We need an element which is really simple. We need an atomic element which has one proton
and one electron.
That must put it. Oh, no, but this element, this atomic element, must be.
That's exactly right.
Well
I've
done.
Actually got a balloon full of hydrogen here.
Andrew, is that hydrogen? I thought that. Okay, Andrew, no, Andrew. Hydrogen is a very dangerous
why?
Gas. I'm going
why
to take that away from you.
That looks like fun.
Because in rockets, you know, with space rockets, they use liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, and they mix them together and set it on fire, and that makes a big enough explosion that it actually gets rockets all the way up into space.
Sorry.
Now, Andrew over there has hydrogen in a balloon, and there's oxygen in the air, so if you guys could just block your ears, I'm going to put these on and run away.
Is everyone ready? 3, 2, 1.
That was very naughty of you, but we have to explain that's not how we use hydrogen in a particle accelerator.
No, so actually what we want is the proton from inside the middle of the hydrogen. So I've got here a model of a hydrogen atom. We've got a single proton, which is in the middle, positively charged, and an electron, which orbits around the outside because it's negatively charged. And as we said earlier, positive and negative charges attract each other. So you find that the electron orbits around the proton, just like the Earth orbits around the Sun, because they're stuck together by gravity. So we actually don't want both of these. We only want the proton. So one way that we could try to separate them is by using a really, really big voltage. So I want you to imagine this half of the audience, you're really, really positive, positively charged, very
happy,
shiny,
smiley faces, excellent,
smiles.
Very good. Yeah,
just
I know it's early, okay.
Explosion.
Happy smiley faces,
you guys,
positive.
A bit more negative. It's not going so well so far.
Really negative, yeah, having a bad morning.
Okay,
yeah.
So
all right.
This proton is positively charged. Which way is it going to go?
It's positively charged. Is it going to go to the positive side or the negative side?
That's right, it's going
excellent.
To go over there.
Negative side. Well
and the
done.
Electron is going to go over to you guys.
Yep.
Well held, sir. And then we can take the protons and take them away and use them in our particle accelerator.
Okay, so that's how we get protons to use in the Large Hadron Collider. And actually, all of the protons come from this for the Large Hadron Collider come from this tiny little bottle of hydrogen gas here. So that's where we get them from. So coming back to our recipe, we now know how to get particles. But the next part of our challenge is how to give them some energy. And Andrew said before, when he threw the balls either side there, he said that he was using a high voltage. And we can actually use a voltage to give particles energy as well. And I've got a demonstration here which is going to involve a bit of high voltage, for which I will need a cunning volunteer. If anyone is game.
Who's got nice long light coloured
hair? Medium length, fairly light coloured hair.
Is anyone keen?
No, I only want someone who's actually okay, can I have quiet for a second? Let's see. Will you volunteer? No? Okay. Let's see. Who will we point? This person here, will you volunteer? Either of you? Come on. It's not that bad, I promise. All right. Nope, not that one.
Anyone? Let's not go at the back.
There's one here. Will you volunteer? Yeah.
Can we have a round of applause, please?
All right, can I just have you guys being quiet just for a minute? Come up here, what's your name?
Izzy.
Okay, Izzy, can you, do you have any metal watches or bangles or jewellery or anything on? Nope, okay. Izzy, isn't it? Can I get you to step up on that step? That's the way, and just face the audience. And can you put your right hand on top of the dome here? That's the way, just nice and flat. I'll just pull the sleeve up a bit. And I'm gonna give you some of this kind of confetti to hold. So you can hold out your left hand and just hold that out in front of you, okay? Right, so what I'm gonna ask you to do, Izzy, is when I've switched it on, don't take your hand off, but if you accidentally do, don't try and put it back on. Got that? That's all I need you to know. Happy?
Yeah.
Okay. Right, so the first thing, watch that confetti in her hand. Can you wiggle your fingers a bit for me, Izzy? That's the way. Okay. And just put that, Izzy, that left hand, can you do that? Yep. Oh dear. Izzy, have you ever been in a shampoo commercial? Can you pretend you're in one and just, give us a bit of a flick? Excellent, okay. So what's happening here, it is very, very good actually. Your hair is perfect for this. Okay, so I just want to explain for a second, while Izzy's hair gets going, what's happening here is, this machine here builds up a very high voltage. It builds up lots of electric charge. And that's all going on to Izzy's body. Now, when she had the pieces of foil in her hand, they all had the same electric charge on them. And so they push away from each other and jumped out of her hand. Now, all of her hair has the same charge on it, but it's got nowhere to go. So instead of jumping off her hand or off her head, it just stands on end and kind of all pushes away from one another. And I have to say, that does look quite spectacular. So give us another flick, Izzy. There we go. Beautiful. All right, shall we leave her up there all day?
Yeah.
They're not very nice to you, are they, Izzy? All right, I'll be good. Can you take that hand off and jump down onto the floor with 2 feet? Excellent. Give her a round of applause.
It's not coming down.
High five. Excellent. She's just about back to normal. She'll be okay. Okay, so we can use a high voltage like this with charged particles because it will make the charged particles push away from the voltage and that gives them some energy. Now we can tell how much voltage was on Izzy's body there by making some sparks. So I'm just gonna, oh, that one was only little. That's a bit better, okay. So. When we make a spark, what we have to do is actually break down the air using the electric voltage. And to break down air actually requires about 30,000 volts of electricity. So those sparks, they're about 3 or 4 centimeters long, aren't they? So 3 or 4 centimetres times 30,000 volts per centimetre means that we had about 100,000 volts sitting on Izzy's body there before. So that doesn't sound particularly safe, does it? So does anyone dare me to spark myself with this? Are you sure? Do you dare me? No. You sure? All right, hang on. I'm going to do it. Are you ready? Can we grab some lights for a second? Shh. Are you ready? What if I die? Is that okay? No, I'm just kidding. It doesn't really hurt, because the reason is that there's lots and lots of charge there, there's lots of voltage, but there's no current flowing through my body. And that's why it's actually perfectly safe. Now, if you were to put your finger in the electric socket on the wall, does anyone know how many volts come out of the socket on the wall? 240. 240 versus 100,000. Bit different. But the one on the wall has lots of electric current which will flow through your body, and that's what makes it really dangerous. So please don't stick your finger in the plug of the socket on the wall to try and get your hair stand on end. That would be a very bad move. But it makes this machine quite safe. Okay, so what does that have to do with a particle accelerator then?
Well, we could use this as a way of accelerating particles. We could get positively charged protons, put a big negative charge somewhere, suck them towards it, and accelerate them until they're going really, really fast. But the problem is just what Susie showed us. It creates sparks, and so you can try and be really careful and suck all the air out of the room, for example, but eventually you run into a problem that you're going to just get sparks. In fact, the Large Hadron Collider, so we said this was 100,000 volts, the Large Hadron Collider accelerates protons effectively through 7 teravolts, which is 7 million million volts.
Whoa!
And that's such a big voltage that if we used a Van de Graaff generator to accelerate those protons, we'd get sparks that could jump all the way from Geneva in Switzerland and zap us here in Oxford.
But we can't, can we?
So luckily,
no.
That's not how we accelerate the particles in the Large Hadron Collider. But before we explain how you do, I'd like to try and have a think about why. Because 100,000 volts, that sounds like quite a lot to me, I don't know about you. So why on earth would we want to accelerate particles to this massive, massive energy? Well, it turns out that you can use a giant particle accelerator like a huge microscope. And the higher the energy of the particles, the smaller the thing that you can see. So let's just remind you how we see things before we start. So this is a picture of something that's sort of about the human scale, something about sort of meters or centimeters across. And you can just see that stuff with your eyes. The way that that works is that light comes from various light sources around the room, like the sun or the lights on the ceiling. And it hits whatever it is you're looking at, bounces off, and then comes into your eyes, and your eyes detect that light. So the way that we see things is by bouncing stuff off them and detecting that stuff. And you can actually do quite a lot better just with normal light by using an optical microscope. This is a picture of my blood, which I took using one of the microscopes in the physics department, and that's much, much smaller than you could see with just your unaided eye. In fact, we can see things that are about a million times smaller than you can with the naked eye using a microscope. But if you want to do better than that, you're going to need to use a particle accelerator. And the first thing we can do is use something called a scanning electron microscope. Now, the clue here is in the name. This uses electrons. And actually, it's a lot like the television that we described earlier. It zaps the electrons at very high speed into the surface of these things you're looking at. It bounces off, and we use an electron detector to create the image. And what we've got here, actually, is a picture of a snowflake at all different magnifications. So in the top left, you can see the whole snowflake with actually got one of its arms broken off. But we can zoom in and in and in and in. We can get so very close to the molecule. And in fact, to the snowflake. And in fact, we can see things that are about a billion times smaller than with the naked eye using an electron microscope. So if you want to see anything smaller than that, you actually are going to need a proper particle accelerator. And this is the kind of thing that you can see if you go to somewhere like Isis or Diamond, which we mentioned earlier. This is a hemoglobin protein, which is the protein in your blood that carries all the oxygen around your body. And in order to see this, we're actually looking at how the molecule is put together. You're going to need to get a nice big particle accelerator and fire some neutrons or some X-rays at it. And this is an aerial photograph of the place near Didcot, the Rutherford Lab, where these two things are located. There's the ISIS source, which are those two warehouses in the foreground where I do a lot of my research. And there's also Diamond, which is that big silver donut. We've actually got a zoomed-in picture of Diamond next. So this huge, round silver thing looks really quite like a spaceship. is a huge ring which we accelerate electrons up to 3 billion volts and then generate X-rays to try to look inside materials and find out how they work.
Okay, so the question is, in something like diamond, we have electrons which are accelerated with about 3 billion volts, which is much, much higher than we can get with one of these machines. So how do we do that? Well, the first thing you notice is that it's a circle. So that means we don't need to give it all of that energy in one go. We can give it a little bit on each turn around and send it around heaps and heaps of times, and then eventually it will end up gaining lots and lots of energy. Now, the other way we do it is we don't use something like this. What we use instead is a wave. And that sounds a little bit strange. So what I want to do is show you guys how you can use a wave to accelerate a particle. And for that, I'm going to need some scale model protons, which hopefully my colleagues out there are going to fetch for us. They seem to just be grabbing them. Okay, so can we have them all down one side here? And you can remember at the start, right? You can already remember that we did a Mexican wave at the start. This is where this is going to come into practice, because you guys are going to be a wave, and these are our particles. So if you guys can hand one of those to people on the end here, and I apologize to the people up the top there, we can't get them up the top to you today. Okay. So, all right, guys, so when we're ready, when I count down, what you have to do, you're not just lobbing them across the room, you actually have to do the Mexican wave and let them ride the wave like a surfer on a water wave and be accelerated across to that side. Are you ready? 3, 2, 1, go! Okay. Ooh. All right, can you hold them, please? Okay, Roslyn, can you give that one out to someone? Thank you. Hold on to them back there. Okay, can you hold on to them, please? Thank you. Can you hold it? Thank you. And just pass it back down the end.
Right, we'd like them all to start on this side again, okay?
Okay, we're going to start on this
side
again.
So not in the middle.
All right.
Okay, so are we ready to try that again? 3, 2, 1, go. I guess you guys can see why we don't just use a Mexican wave to accelerate particles.
It's a bit messy.
We actually use a different kind of wave, not a wave made of people, but a wave that's called an electromagnetic wave. Now that might be a bit hard to understand, so I've got a demonstration that can show you how it works, but I'm going to need a volunteer.
Okay, not just any volunteer.
Don't just put all your hands up at once, because I need someone quite special. I need someone
You're all special.
Who thinks, I need someone who thinks they can light this fluorescent light bulb, which is like perhaps the light bulb you might have on your ceiling at home, in the kitchen. This needs to be lit with just your bare hands. Do you really think you can do that? Come on, give it a go. Can we have a round of applause, please? Was your name Molly? Did I guess? Wow. Okay, so Molly, this is the tube. Go.
Right, so hold it in both your hands. There you go. Yep. And well, you said you could
do it.
You
said you could do it, now.
Well, that's embarrassing, isn't it?
That is really. Do you want a hand? Okay, can you just pop those down a bit? So what we've got, keep that down to 25. So what we've got here is something called a plasma ball, okay? And what I'd like you to do, when the lights just go down in a second, if... So yeah, you might have seen one of these before. What you need to do is bring the fluorescent tube up near the plasma ball, but don't touch it. Okay? Oh, there we go.
Don't you dare take pictures.
So although this isn't actually touching the plasma ball, I can put my hand in between, just turn it off. But you can see it's lighting up. There's another trick you can do. If you put your hand in different places on the length of the tube, just grab it in the middle, you can see it actually turns off at the back. So can everyone see that working? You can turn it on halfway down. In fact, you can do it wherever you want.
That's incredible.
It's sort of like having a lightsaber. So that's brilliant. Thank you, Molly, for that. Those amazing skills.
Thank you, Molly.
So it turns out, sorry, Molly, you're not magic. There's actually a scientific reason that that worked. And that reason is that we use an electromagnetic wave to accelerate the particles in this tube. The way the plasma ball works is it has a very big voltage in the middle, but it's not a constant voltage like the Van de Graaff generator had. It's an alternating voltage which goes up and down, up and down, up and down, about 30,000 times a second. And that means that when you bring the fluorescent tube near it, it gets hit by an electromagnetic wave. It's a bit like if you throw a stone into a pond and the ripples all expand outwards. And these waves accelerate the electrons inside the tube. That causes a current to flow, and then that current is what makes the tube light up.
Okay, but still, we don't have thousands of plasma balls sitting around the Large Hadron Collider accelerating particles. What we do have is something which looks a little bit more like this. Now, this is actually the smallest one of these devices in the entire world. But what it is, we call it a radio frequency cavity, which is quite a sophisticated word. But what it is we take these waves, these electromagnetic waves, and we pump them inside here through these ports. Now, inside here is kind of like a bunch of little tiny boxes all joined together. And then this one is actually designed for an electron accelerator. And you can see there's a tiny little hole in the center there. So the electrons go through that hole, through this device. And when the waves are inside there, the electromagnetic waves, these electrons ride along the wave, just like a surfer riding a water wave, and they gain a bit of energy as they go through. So they only gain a little bit of energy when they go through, though. So what we have to do to get lots and lots of energy is get lots and lots of these and put them all in a row and let the particles go through them again and again and again, and then they'll gain lots and lots of energy. But as I said, this is actually the smallest one in the entire world, so we're very lucky to have it. But in the Large Hadron Collider, they're a little bit bigger, and this is a real radio frequency cavity from the LHC. These are real size men, they're not the scale models. So that's just a little bit bigger there, and there's a couple of hundred of those in that Large Hadron Collider spaced around the ring, and that's what gives the protons their energy as they zip around and around. So we've got our energy. What's next?
Well, we've got our particles. We did that by ripping apart hydrogen. We've given them energy by using electromagnetic waves, or like the beach ball wave that we just showed you. The next thing we've got to do is control the beam, so to try and control where it goes, because there's no point having these fast-moving particles if they're just going everywhere. And the way that we do that is using magnets. And to show you what that means, I'm going to have to turn off the lights. Okay, and set that going. Right, so what we've got here, this is called a cathode ray tube, and that's just a posh name for the bit that's inside one of those old-fashioned TVs. I've got two controls, which we can't see very much of at the moment. That's a bit of a problem. Could I have the lights back on? Thank you. That's quite... Oh, there we go. Sorry. Yes, and can we have the lights off again? Okay, so we've actually got two controls down there, which I'm just going to show you by pointing the camera at them. That one on the left controls the energy of the electrons, so how fast they're going. And that one on the right controls the magnet, controls how powerful the magnet is. Okay, so I'll just pan that back up. And hopefully, if I turn on the energy of the electrons, taking this up to about sort of 300 or something appearing on there. Oh, I've put that a bit too low. So can everyone see that little sort of blue-green smudge on the right-hand side? That is electrons passing through the gas inside the tube. We've got a special gas in there that means it glows when the electrons go through. And the electrons are actually doing something a bit boring now. They're coming out of the cathode, like in the back of a TV, and they're smashing into the globe on the glass globe that we showed you before. So what we can do is we can apply, we can put electric current through the magnets and get them working. And so hopefully...
So what you're doing there, Andrew, is you're using a magnet to bend a beam of particles. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So can you all see that's now made a tiny little circle? That's because as the electrons travel through the magnet, their path is bent round. And there's another thing that we can do. We can try turning up the energy of the electrons. Let's see what happens to the circle then. Can everybody see the circle's getting bigger? In fact, quite a lot bigger. And that's because when you have higher energy particles, you need a bigger magnetic field to bend them round. So actually, if we turn the power of the magnet up, can you all see that shrinking back down again now?
Okay, so if you have a high energy beam, you need really strong magnets, is
really,
that right?
Really strong magnets, exactly.
Okay.
So if we can have the lights back up again, I can show you that these aren't just magnets like you might stick on your fridge. These magnets are created by this big red coil here. Can everyone see that? And that's because they're called electromagnets. So the way that we generate the magnet is by passing electricity through those coils. And to get a bigger field, you need to pass more and more current through.
Okay, so all I need to do is I need to get lots and lots of electricity and pass it through a really sort of big coil. And then I'm going to make a really, really strong magnet which can control our beams in the Large Hadron Collider.
That sounds like a good idea.
The only problem with that, though, is... Nice glasses, hey. The only problem is that... with that is when you run too much electricity through a piece of wire. So I've got a little thin piece of wire here, which is actually called steel wool. And if I just run some electricity through there, not on that one. Can you see what's happening? Okay, so as I run electricity through, the wire's heated up. And if you run too much electricity through there, you get too much heat, and then it actually just burns like that. Which I have to say is not much use when you're trying to make a magnet, because a magnet that sets on fire is not going to be much use to anyone.
So the reason that wire gets hot is because of something called electrical resistance. And that's the fact that when you pass an electric current through a wire, it heats up. Now, we can make use of that effect. That's the way that your kettle or an electric fire works. When you pass current through the element inside there, it warms up and it warms your drink or it warms your room. But in a giant magnet, we don't really want it to warm up. We want it to generate a magnetic field. So we need to use something that has no electrical resistance.
Ah, well, you know, I've heard of something which actually doesn't heat up when you put lots and lots of electricity through it.
What's it called?
It's called a superconductor.
Has anyone heard of superconductors?
Has anyone heard of a superconductor? Oh, a couple of people. Okay.
So there's a bit of a problem with superconductors, though, right? So superconductors have no electrical resistance. You can put an electric current in them, and it goes round and round and round and round forever without heating it up. But they don't work at room temperature. They only work when it's very, very cold.
Now, hang on. I'll let Andrew do this because he likes doing it. This is the most exciting demonstration in the whole show. Are you ready? We have a piece of superconductor, some really strong magnets. Go, Andrew, go. All right, you ready?
So...
That's a bit
here,
rubbish.
This is a piece of superconductor. It's a little piece of ceramic material, so it's a bit like a bathroom tile or a teacup or something like that. And these are some very, very strong magnets. If you bring a bathroom tile near some strong magnets, nothing happens. So we're going to need to make this stuff cold in order for anything interesting to happen to it. Can anyone think of something that's about minus 200 degrees? Liquid nitrogen, that's right. And actually, we've got some liquid nitrogen right here.
I've put one in there.
So, for this next bit, we're going to need a couple of volunteers.
Oh, I need some volunteers. Okay, I'm going to get one from up the top there. Can one of the teachers ask someone to come down?
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, so I've got one from up there and someone from up the back. Oh, let's find someone up here. All right. Who wants to come down? I need a woman. Because I've got a man coming down from upstairs. That sounded odd, didn't it? Well, you're on the end. Would you like to come down? Thank you.
Okay, so Susie is going to get our volunteers, and she's just going to give them some safety equipment. While she does that, I'm going to show you the first of our liquid nitrogen demonstrations. So I've got a bucket of liquid nitrogen right here, and I've got here a piece of ordinary, boring rubber tube. So you can see it's quite bendy, it's quite stretchy when it's warm. What I'm going to do is put the rubber tube into the liquid nitrogen. Okay, so the first thing that happens is we get this rather attractive spray. That's the liquid nitrogen coming out the end of the tube because it's boiling really violently inside here. It's turning from a liquid into a gas. It's forcing the nitrogen out the end of the tube. And you can tell it's cold because this end's still bendy, but the boiling has clearly stopped. The nitrogen isn't spraying out the end anymore. And I can see the warm end is still bendy, but the cold end... it's gone a bit strange, and in fact, you can see it smashes like glass, and we've changed the material properties of this stuff very substantially by cooling it down.
Okay.
So it's quite an important lesson in material science, this. If you're building a machine that's going to contain a lot of liquid nitrogen, you can't use rubber seals because they'll just smash, they'll shatter like glass, and you'll get nitrogen everywhere, which is a really bad idea.
Okay, so I think what we need to do next, we have Rachel and James here. And Rachel, I'm sorry that you get this job, but I have to give Andrew some flowers. So can you hold those for a second? Now, Andrew's a little bit strange. He likes his flowers really, really cold. So what I'll do with you is we'll just put these, if they'll fit, in the liquid nitrogen. And can you hear that bubbling and boiling away there?
Do you want to hang on to them? Don't lose
them.
There
you go. So it's bubbling and boiling away, and that's because the nitrogen is so cold that even something warm, you know, room temperature like flowers is really warm to it. So it bubbles and boils away, and as it cools down, can you hear that that's not really boiling so much anymore? Okay, so that's because the flowers have reached the same temperature, about minus 200 degrees, as the liquid nitrogen. So what I'll get you to do now, Rachel, is if you can just pull those out and just smash them over Andrew's head. Go on, smash them with him. Go on. Excellent. Job done.
So that's, we saw what happens with the rubber tube. That's what happens if you put living things inside nitrogen. All the water in their cells freezes, and when it does that, they become brittle like glass. So that's why you've got to be careful with this stuff. If you put your hands or your face into that liquid nitrogen, it would just smash like those flowers did.
Okay, now James, James, I'm not going to get you to attack Andrew. Quiet. Thank you. James, I'm going to give you this cup, and can you just throw it into this mystery liquid here? You girls might want to just watch out. That's the way. Oh! Whoa, okay, so the mystery liquid was bubble mixture. And can you have a look here? Can you see just with your glove? There's actually some crazy frozen bubbles in there. They're kind of a little bit disgusting, aren't they? Ooh, weird. All right, okay. Can we thank our two volunteers, Rachel and James? Thank you very much. Can I grab this back? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And just careful as you walk off the stage there. Excellent.
Okay, so what that demonstration showed us is what happens when nitrogen turns from a liquid into a gas. It expands by about 600 times its normal size. And that means that you've got to be careful when you're dealing with this stuff again, because if you do let it get warm and it heats up, it's going to suddenly get a lot bigger and you can have some serious problems.
Okay, so we've had a bit of fun with liquid nitrogen now, but does anyone remember why we got the liquid nitrogen out in the first place? We needed something really cold. Can anyone remember why? What was it called? What was the thing we were playing with? Do you remember why?
To freeze
the superconductor. Thankfully, someone's keeping us on track here today. All right, so
okay,
Andrew.
So can we have the camera feed up, please, Helen? Thank you. Right, so what you can hopefully see, that's those magnets that I put the superconductor near earlier. And this is a warm piece, and absolutely nothing exciting happens at all. But if I could get a pair of tweezers from here. We've got a piece of superconductor in here that's been bubbling away for a while, and it's nice and cold. If I can just grab it out. There we go. Is everyone ready?
Whoa!
So can you all see that?
So that's actually levitating above the magnet.
And then, when it warms up, you can see it's just starting to sag a little bit. As soon as it warms up above the temperature at which it becomes superconducting, it just flops back down onto the magnets again. So do you want to see that one more time?
Yeah, do it again.
So what happens is when you bring the superconductor near to the magnets, it acts a bit like a magnetic mirror. It reflects the poles of the magnets. And because like poles, like charges repel, the superconductor floats. It disobeys gravity. But as soon as it warms up again, it stops being a superconductor and just falls back onto the surface.
Cool. I think Andrew deserves a round of applause for that. Well done. Okay, so that's pretty cool, I have to say. But we actually don't use that weird levitating thing in our magnets in the Large Hadron Collider. But what we can do is we can use this crazy superconductor stuff to make magnets that don't heat up when we put lots and lots of electricity through them. So that means that we can use a superconductor to make really, really strong magnets. And in that way, we can actually control the beam that we've got and bend it around circles. So if I just come back to the recipe that we had particles, we We got them from the hydrogen. And then we managed to give them some energy using voltages and the waves that you guys made. And then we controlled where the beam went using really powerful magnets made out of superconductors. So the next thing we need to do is figure out how to collide them together. And, well, I think I might need you guys to help me again. And for this, I think, again, I'm going to need some scale model protons. But while they're getting them, I'm going to explain. We're going to do two different types of collisions today. And the two types are called particle-particle collisions, where we get two beams of particles and collide them together. And the other one is a fixed target collision, getting particles and hitting them into something solid. Now, just before we hand these out,
half the beach balls on each side of the room, please?
Yeah, sorry, half on each side. Before we hand the beach balls out this time, once they've collided, I need you to move them very quickly to the edge of the room, okay? So they need to end up on the sides, not thrown around everywhere this time. So we're going to have three on each side, I think, or two and three. That's all right. Okay. That's close enough.
So we're going to try to collide the particles at a point just in the middle of the room, okay? So imagine there's a space in the middle of the room. Aim your beach ball for there, and hopefully it'll smash together with another beach ball.
So this is what's called a particle-particle collision, and it's not easy, so you're going to have to try hard. So do you guys want to choose a few people to give one of those beach balls to? Yep.
Is everyone ready?
So we need the balls to collide
down.
In the middle.
Three,
it's not easy. Three,
two,
one, go! That was rubbish.
That was...
Right, to the sides, guys. All right.
Okay, can we get the beach balls back to the edge of the room, please? So that was hopeless. We'd got beach balls everywhere and only two of them collided together once.
That was rubbish. And if you think that's hard, you should try colliding real protons, because this, all we asked you to do was collide these massive balls from opposite sides of the lecture theatre, and you missed entirely. It wasn't that hard. But in the Large Hadron Collider, we're colliding two things which, you know, are absolutely tiny, and it's like colliding grains of sand from opposite sides of the Earth. That's how difficult it really is. So to make it a little bit easier, the next type of collision we're going to do is called a fixed target collision.
So in a fixed target collision, you have just the beam of particles moving and something stationary that you try and smash them into.
Okay, so I'm going to need something stationary. Andrew, can you just walk halfway down the side there? Is that all right?
Do you think I'll find a target?
Yeah, I think you're looking for a target down there, Andrew. Just have a look. And Andrew, if you just stop there and just cover your eyes for a second, because I think I can see a target.
This is going to make looking for a target harder.
Hold that. I think I can see a target, so hand those out quickly. All right. Andrew, it's all right. We're just finding a target. It's okay. We're just finding a target. Right. Andrew's the target. 3, 2, 1, go!
Okay, that was... Ow! Oh. That was very nearly the speed of light.
Okay. All right, Andrew, I'm terribly sorry about that. Sorry, I couldn't find another target, so I had to use you. But what you'll notice... Did you get hit then?
I think I got hit...
Quite a few times.
In fact, I got hit more times than there were beach balls, which is pretty suspicious.
That is a little bit suspicious, guys. All right, but you notice that colliding particles with a fixed target is much easier than colliding them head on. So why do we collide them head on in the Large Hadron Collider?
The answer is we're trying to get more and more energy. So you imagine if you've got two particle beams coming together like that, then there's going to be much, much more energy than if you collide just one moving beam with something that's not moving.
Because in the fixed case, you only have the energy of one beam, whereas in the other one, you've got the combined energy of both beams. I see. Okay.
So why do we want all this energy? Well, the answer is that we want them to use in these different particle collisions. And in a particle accelerator as big as the Large Hadron Collider, that's where the idea that we had about giant microscopes sort of breaks down. This is a cartoon of a particle collision. And before, you can see there are two protons whizzing along. Then they smash together, bang! And afterwards, two completely different particles fly out. Now, this is pretty weird. You're creating stuff that simply wasn't there before. And it's a bit like lobbing together two apples really, really hard and getting three bananas and a mango.
That's really weird.
So the reason this is possible is due to probably the most famous equation in physics. Does anyone know what that is?
Oh, really famous
equation. Yeah, we got one. E equals mc squared. Does anyone know what the letters mean?
Yeah, do you know what they mean? What's E? Energy. What's M?
Yeah, mass.
Well done. And C?
And C
is the speed of light.
Okay.
Well done.
So what this equation means is that you can turn energy into mass. So you can turn energy into stuff. But the exchange rate is C squared, the speed of light squared. Now, the speed of light is 299,792,458 meters a second. That's a pretty big number.
Exactly.
If you multiply it by itself, that's a huge number. And that means it takes a massive amount of energy to create a tiny amount of mass. So to create a single gram of matter requires the same amount of energy you'd need to drive a car around the Earth 700 times.
Wow. Okay. So just coming back to our recipe for a second, can we? We've started by getting some particles, and then we gave them some energy, we've managed to control them, and now, thanks to you guys, though I have to say you weren't very good at it, we've managed to collide them together. And the next part in our recipe is how to detect them. And before I show you a detector, I want to ask you a question. Put up your hand if you think that right now there are particles from outer space passing through your body. Let me give you a clue. Good. Okay. All right, thank you. So that sounds pretty weird, doesn't it, that there are particles from outer space. But actually, there are particles called muons coming from outer space and passing through our bodies. What's a muon? Well, they were only actually discovered in about 1936. And they're formed from cosmic rays coming from outer space, hitting our atmosphere, and they form these particles, charged particles called muons, which come through and pass through us. And there's about 10,000 of them going through every square meter of the Earth, of the Earth's surface, every minute. So as we sit here, and as I've explained this to you, there's been a few going through each one of us every second. But we can't see them, we can't feel them, we can't taste them. So what we need is a particle detector in order to see them. And I've got one over here, which is called a cloud chamber. If we can get the feed going. Is this... That's a little bit hard to see.
There we go.
Yep, I think you can just about see. There's some little white streaks coming across occasionally. And what that is, these are the muons actually passing through this cloud chamber. And the reason it can see them is because inside here, we have alcohol vapor from an alcohol called propanol. And as the particles pass through, it actually forms little tiny droplets, which appear to us like little tiny streaks of cloud. So even though we can't see these particles with our naked eye, we can actually see them using a particle detector like this cloud chamber.
Now, that used to be the cutting edge of particle physics, but actually now we've got slightly more advanced detectors, you'll be pleased to hear. So this is a picture of the ATLAS detector in the Large Hadron Collider. It's actually a picture before they put any of the detector electronics inside. And just take a second to look at this picture. Can you see there's a man stood there? Again, he's a fully grown man, so this is a pretty big room. It's actually 22 meters across, 42 meters long, and when you cram it full of detector electronics, this thing weighs 7,000 tons. It's actually quite like a digital camera, and you might have a digital camera at home. So it might have maybe 10 megapixels, 15 megapixels if you've got a good one. This thing, right, it's 100 megapixels.
Andrew, that's not very good. It's 22 meters long, weighs 7,000 tons, but it's only as good as 10 digital cameras.
Yeah, you're right, that is a bit rubbish.
That doesn't sound very good.
So, how many pictures can a digital camera take every second? Maybe three or four? If you've got a video camera, it might take 25 frames every second. This thing does 40 million pictures every second.
Wow, okay, so that's the difference. This thing takes 40 million pictures a second, and it's taking pictures of stuff which a digital camera can't even see, so it's quite a specialised device, really. So when you take 40 million pictures a second, and remember, each one of them is a 100 megapixel image, that's going to fill up your memory card pretty quickly. And so the scientists at CERN have actually had to develop a whole new way of computing and networking computers together, which they call the grid. And so we get these computing centers, this is the one at CERN, all over the world, connected together via the grid. And they've had to develop this just to actually treat all of the information that they're getting out of these experiments. And it's that information that they then use in universities and institutes all over the world to actually answer some of the big questions about the universe that they're trying to get at. And that's why they've built this experiment in the first place. So just
going
back to the
recipe. That brings us to the end of our recipe. So we got particles from hydrogen by ripping it apart. We gave them energy using waves. We controlled the beam using giant superconducting electromagnets and took it to where we wanted it to go. The place we wanted it to go was particle collision. When we smashed these particles together, we created a load of new particles that simply weren't there before. And finally, we used particle detectors to work out what it was we'd done.
Okay, so just finally, we'd like to take you on a little bit of a tour with some photographs of the Large Hadron Collider and the four detectors which make up the experiments on the collider. And so this is what we saw before. This is down 100 metres underground inside the Large Hadron Collider tunnel, and these are the magnets that bend the beam around the corner in the accelerator. And then this is ATLAS, which is one of two general-purpose detectors in the Large Hadron Collider, which is looking for, among other things, something called the Higgs boson. What's the Higgs boson, Andrew?
Well, the Higgs boson is a theoretical particle that people think should exist in order to explain a rather embarrassing problem we physicists have got. We've got a very precise theory called the Standard Model, which explains a lot of stuff about how particles behave. But the one thing it doesn't explain is why anything at all has mass. Now, mass is pretty simple. You'd think that might be something that we'd already understood. But in fact, without this particle, we just don't know where it comes from. And although it's been predicted in theory, we've just never seen it in an experiment. So one of the things that these detectors are looking for is a signature of this Higgs boson to explain this embarrassing problem that we physicists don't know where mass comes from.
Okay, so that brings us almost to the end of our show, but I'd just like to say that all the time that we're developing these huge experiments and these huge detectors in order to answer these really important questions about the universe, at the same time, the technology that's been developed is spinning out into all areas of society, because remember that this is just one accelerator amongst about 20,000 of them on the Earth, and most of them are used for things like medicine and in industry for making computer chips, for doing history, for looking up viruses, for developing new medicines to cure diseases, all sorts of areas that they're used for. So I'd like to encourage you to always ask big questions, ask important questions, ask even if you think it's a stupid question, because there's no such thing as a stupid question. Truly, there is not. Because it's only when you start asking questions that's when things get interesting.
Okay, so we like to finish the show with a bang. Would anyone like us to blow up another hydrogen balloon?
Yeah.
So actually,
you've got three. Oh, we're in trouble. All right, I just moved that back there a little bit. All right,
okay, is everyone
guys.
Ready?
We're going to have a countdown. We're going to put these on from 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Woo!
Thanks, everybody.